I'm a caterpillar crawling for your love, crawling for your love, crawling for your love, for your love. I'm a butterfly.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today, we try to empathize with the insects in our lives, what they go through to give us the world that we often take for granted. We like to laugh about an overabundance of zucchini, but without a sufficient bee population, those days of stuffed zucchini, zucchini bread, zucchini slaw, sautéed zucchini, zucchini muffins, and all the rest could become a thing of the past. Joining us now for this empathy session is Mark Berman, founder and president of Bugman Educational Enterprises. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. That's so poetic. Beautiful.
Well, you know, I just feel like we got to give some praise to our bugs.
And this is a good show for it, too. We've got all different ways to praise them. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, too, Mark. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So let's talk about, we got some incredibly beautiful specimens of moths in the studio with us that I want to talk about. But before we go there.
Well, they're going to start flying around and change the whole nature of the show.
Yeah, we'll be running around, although they aren't going to be giant tarantulas. So, although you did bring a tarantula, just in case.
If it comes up.
50 to 80% of the honeybees raised in Ohio by Ohio's registered beekeepers died last winter. What happened?
It was tough.
We don't know.
Well, most people don't know. Actually, I don't think anybody knows fully. A lot of people have different ideas about, you know, the big phenomenon is called colony collapse disorder. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of two different major ecological bad phenomena going on now that are related. And the bees are one of them, and monarch butterflies are another one. And those two are both such sort of showy, popular bugs that they're getting a lot of attention. And our love-hate relationship with bees is outweighed by our need to eat and how important they are. The difference between those two systems, though, is that honeybees are an imported monoculture. They're kind of a not natural system. The migration of the monarch butterflies through North America to Mexico is one of the more amazing natural phenomena that humans didn't have anything to do with until we started to ruin it. And so those two things probably are both a result of the same ecological factors, but they're completely different systems that probably require somewhat different responses. For instance, both of them, increasing native pollinators, pollinating plants, you know, food for them to eat is one of the keys to helping both of them out. But for the monarchs, having host plant for the caterpillars is also really important. So milkweeds, and there's this big, huge drive now to plant monarch butterfly way stations where you have lots of pollinating plants and then lots of milkweeds where they can lay eggs and to support that whole population. With honeybees, I don't even know what's going to happen. Most of the drive now is to try to replace a lot of the work they do with native pollinators. And you do that by planting a lot of native plants and flowers that'll attract them, giving them places to make nests. And we can talk about that more as we go along. Mm-hmm. But the honeybee collapse is an interesting thing. We're very, very dependent on a really unnatural system in agriculture in a lot of ways. Honeybees are just one of them. Mm-hmm. If a huge cow virus started going across the country, we would have really big problems also. Although weaning ourselves from cows isn't a bad idea, but we're really dependent on honeybees. And so it's a big problem and nobody knows exactly why.
So when you talk about the native plants and that sort of thing, how do we know what a native plant is anymore? And don't we just need to have plants that are pollinating plants?
Well, a perfect example of why that doesn't work is purple loosestrife. I don't know if you ever heard
right.
of purple loosestrife, but if you ever see
lots of commercial developments have it.
Yeah, and if you ever see like a calendar picture of a little stream with a valley and it's got all these big, beautiful purple flowers all over it, that's an ecological disaster. And that plant got spread across the country by, you know, mostly in the day, little old ladies with gardens mm-hmm. who sent seeds to their friends across the country, and also a lot of the religious movements that went across the country took gardens with them, and it's such a beautiful ornamental, and it was supposed to be a safe ornamental that couldn't reproduce or anything, but it gets loose and it takes over a wetlands, and it provides pollen for some species. But because it's because it didn't sort of evolve here and doesn't have the checks and balances on it that most of the ecosystems have that grow up together, when it gets introduced, it can take over. And a plant like that likes wetlands, so its roots are wet. You can't sort of like burn out a whole patch of it. It makes tons of flowers, and nothing else can grow around it. And so it doesn't provide the same ecological resource that a large, diverse, you know, biohabitat would. That's the problem with most of the non-native plants that the habitat isn't sort of prepared for outcompete the native plants. And, you know, native wildlife is much more tuned into native plants, obviously.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. With me today to talk about bugs and the bug's life is Mark Berman. He's founder and president of Bugman Educational Enterprises. If you have a question or comment about summer bugs or bugs in general, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Even the White House is getting involved in saving honeybees and pollinators. They've called for, you know, habitat regeneration.
They have big... President Obama released a presidential, whatever they call
statement
it,
statement or something like that. Yeah.
I don't know exactly how it qualified, but to appoint committees, and he designated different individuals from different departments who would serve on the committees to sort of study the whole issue of pollinators. You know, our culture has sort of grown to be superimposed on nature. We sort of almost live in spite of nature, and we don't pay a whole lot of attention to what goes on around us in the real world, and especially the way we eat. We're the first culture that really doesn't have a real connection with our food. We don't know where it comes from. We don't know who makes it. We don't know what it was before it was food. You know, during programs, a lot of times when I get a little bit out of control, I'll be like, a clown walks up to you and says, try this McBurger. And you're like, okay, Ronald. And, you know, you don't even ask what's in it. And he's a clown. And we have no idea about our food. And so our inability or our unwillingness to plant wildflowers also, I mean, wildflowers are beautiful, you know, and we should be attracting this stuff to our yard.
Why there's been a push to, well, what about the monarch butterfly way stations that you were talking about? How would one develop one of those?
There's a site called monarchwatch.org where you can go and get all of this information about monarchs. And they have a lot of educational curricula. There's a lot of teachers who will order, I hope they're not listening right now and feel bad, but they'll order painted lady butterflies. And you can get this little kit. It's kind of cool, where they give you little cups that have artificial dye in them and little caterpillars, and then the caterpillars grow up and make a chrysalis, and then they'll give you like a big netted thing that you can have the butterflies in, and they say until their wings dry out, and then you can release them. And what you're doing then is releasing sort of non-native, even though painted lady butterflies live here, ones that were raised in lab populations that eat artificial diet, and you're setting loose a bunch of fertile herbivores to go out and live in our habitat that didn't really come from here. And so the lesson of showing kids the life cycle and metamorphosis is great, but monarch butterflies are much more beautiful. They show the same thing, and for free, you can plant milkweeds on your school ground. And even though it's called milkweed, it's a beautiful plant that smells great and gets a whole community of wildlife around it. So it's not just monarchs, but it gets tons of different pollinators, and there's usually aphids on it, which attract ants, and there's milkweed beetles and milkweed bugs and just a whole lot of really cool animals that live in and around milkweed. And then you've got that whole lesson right there, and you're supporting the natural habitat instead of you know, releasing like a painted lady. But the point I was going to make, I'm sorry, was I keep losing track of.
That's okay.
I got so much excited.
Yeah,
stuff
I know you always do.
And so at monarchwatch.org, if you're a teacher and you choose to do that, you can also get wing tags for your monarchs so that when they make their migration, you can tag their wings. And when somebody finds them, they contact Monarch Watch and you can kind of find out if your monarch
how far they made it.
Yeah, and if it gets found on the trail. And it also plugs you into this whole network across all of North America and part of South America of classrooms and enthusiasts and people who are sort of tracking this whole migration thing. And the crisis with the monarchs, the way they measure them usually is, you know, all the monarchs east of the Rockies go to the same place in Mexico, except for a few in Florida. And so all of these billions of monarchs are in this really small area in the mountains in Mexico. And they'll fly over and estimate the acreage to estimate how many butterflies there are, however many millions per acre.
Uh-huh.
The peak in the 90s was 40 acres. Last summer was 2 acres. That's the difference between 40 acres and 2 acres. That's the kind of crisis that population is in. And that's a huge bottleneck. All of them are there. So something happens when they're down there and that's it.
I've noticed this year, and it may be because of what I've planted in my garden, but more butterflies. But no monarchs.
Yeah.
Not one this year.
Yeah.
And I remember growing up, they were everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
that was our moment of silence for the monarchs. Yeah, they're in real that was our empathy. I know you're not supposed to have dead air on the radio,
no,
but that was it. I mean, that's the answer, is that yeah, you're absolutely right that they are in serious crisis. Last year, I'm trying to remember if I saw 1 or 0 caterpillars. And when we were at Mothapalooza last year, we went out in the field and did a butterfly walk in the daytime. And I said, there's a monarch, but it wasn't a monarch. It was just a butterfly that looked like I felt kind of dumb because I studied monarchs when I was in college, so I should know it.
Wishful thinking.
But yeah, I mean, and you see something that sort of looks like it and you get all excited. But I haven't seen one this year either. I haven't seen an adult. I haven't seen a caterpillar. I haven't seen an egg. And I look, and I don't know if it's distracted driving or not. When you're driving down the freeway and you try to look under the leaves to see if there's caterpillars
that
on them,
that would probably be like texting. I think.
Maybe, I don't know, but I haven't seen any. No matter how fast I'm going, I haven't seen any.
Well, I leave all the caterpillars that do devour my plants. I leave them now. I don't try to
they share
get rid
them.
Of
they
them. Right. They're yeah. sharing them, yeah. and maybe a bird picks them up and wastes them for me. I try not to kill anything in the gardens, including this spider. I tried to get a picture of it this morning, but it's one of those real diaphanous type of spiders. It's proliferated in the garden this year. I've never seen so many of them. They're all over the place, and they have like little silver backs to them and sort of greenish.
Ooh.
And they're everywhere. And I wonder why some years are there these a bug around, you know, are there a certain kind of spider everywhere and why other years not?
And we've talked about it before and you never know. I mean, since we've started doing this, we've had like this whole series of really unusual seasonal weather
yeah.
changes. This year has been almost ideal. We've had a really good,
wow,
a decent winter,
Come
a
on.
Really good spring.
Well, a lot of people hated the winter. It was too cold.
It was the right kind of winter. I mean, it was you know, a historically sort of normal winter. That's
yeah.
how it always used to be.
Right.
And then spring was real mild and nice. And summer, we haven't had a sort of sweltering 2 weeks
right.
like we usually. It's early yet, but this has been almost idyllic. And so, I don't know, but it changes, and they're fickle. They just, who knows, they're fickle. But by the way, the things that you plant in your garden will make a huge difference. And when you, and people plant gardens because they like pretty flowers. Pretty flowers go out and just sit there and don't really do anything except sit there and die, and then you got to go maintain them. But if you plant pretty flowers that people think of as weeds, but they're still pretty flowers, and you put them in the right place and you learn about the world you live in instead of the garden store down the street, then you attract all kinds of things. And then when you're sitting out on the porch having iced tea watching the garden, there's stuff, you know, you can say, oh, look at that pretty flower. Oh, look at that pretty flower. Ooh, look. But then stuff starts flying by mm-hmm. and landing and doing and, you know, eating. And then it's very exciting and there's lots of stories to tell. Native gardens are much better. There are people who even have replaced their lawns. Like
yes.
they don't do grass anymore. They just have, and that's what I want.
That's Mark Berman. He's the founder and president of Bugman Educational Enterprises. If you have a question or comment about bugs, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
spider met a cricket in a field of flax and clover. Said the spider to the cricket, will you be my true lover? Singing tra-la-la-la-la-la, singing tra-la-la-la-la-la, singing tra-la-la-la-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la-la-la-la.
Oh, welcome back to All Sides, where it's Empathize with a Bug Day.
I could have gotten you better bug than you.
I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Still with me for this empathy session is entomologist Mark Berman, founder and president of Bugman Educational Enterprises. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Before we move on to Mothapalooza. From a couple weeks ago. Let's take a few calls. Suzanne in Delaware, Ohio. You want to talk about monarch caterpillars. Hi, Suzanne. Hi, oops.
Hi.
Hi, Suzanne.
This is Cynthia.
Yep. Is it Cynthia?
Yeah, Cynthia from Galloway.
Oh, it says Delaware, Ohio, but I'll talk to you anyways. Cynthia, go for it.
This year, I let the milkweeds grow. My husband rolls his eyes and thinks they should be killed. But like you said, I haven't seen any monarch caterpillars. I have all the ants. I have the aphids. The milkweeds smell absolutely great.
Yeah.
How do I get the monarch caterpillar to the milkweed?
Kidney.
I fell in love with the monarchs when I was in California and went to a place called Natural Bridges near Santa Cruz, and there were just thousands and thousands of monarchs, and they were on their migration path to Mexico. And I just love them.
That's
and
you,
I would
you, there's
love
actually a,
to have them.
There's actually a population in California that overwinters on the coast. All the ones west of the Rockies sort of go to the California coast. All the ones east of the Rockies go down to Mexico. But that's cool. I would love to have seen that.
So what's a caterpillar, a monarch caterpillar look like? I can't even remember.
Oh, they're beautiful.
Yeah. Are they fuzzy kind?
No,
fuzzy?
They're not fuzzy, okay. But they're yellow and black and white striped.
I don't even know how long it's been.
They have series. And then they look like they have big antennas on their heads, but they're really just sort of breaking
horns?
Up the pattern. They're not.
Oh,
no,
right.
They're kind. They look more filamentous than horns.
Okay.
Some caterpillars have horns.
Yeah.
Hornworms have horns. Okay. But the monarchs, it looks like antennas, but they have really little antennas by their mouths. So they're beautiful caterpillars. And as far as Cynthia's garden is concerned, it doesn't sound like you need monarchs. You got a whole lot going on with those milkweeds already. Milkweeds are great, and I wish they would have called them something different.
Well, no one needs monarchs, right?
No, but we all kind of do, and
okay.
I mean, it's such a cool thing.
Yeah.
And so to answer the question more directly, on Facebook, of course, everybody's plugged in with their own stuff, and so I'm really plugged in with the bug world, and people around here have just recently started reporting sightings of monarch caterpillars, which it's late. It's usually near the beginning of June. And
So
it seems like it's late, but it also seems that people have started to find them. And I really discourage everybody in every case, mostly from trying to move things around a whole lot.
Okay.
And so, I know a lot of people who were at Mothapalooza, for example, who were trading eggs and caterpillars and stuff. And those are from sort of ranges in Ohio and probably don't make a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
But when you order something like those painted ladies, or you can even order monarchs from places, and those are not the kinds of things that I think should be released into our native habitat. If it doesn't come from your backyard, basically you don't let it go in your backyard. And so I think if you keep watching your milkweeds, I'm guessing that soon at least some monarchs will show up, and there could be a big flood of them at some point. I also know if you do want to see some at Blendon Woods, and I think I mentioned this before, Sarah Dalton, the naturalist at Blendon Woods, is sort of like the big monarch lady. And so she's got, every year she's got beautiful displays, and you can see the whole life cycle, and then she's got a big flight net out in the backyard, and even during some parts of the season, she'll give away treated seeds for milkweeds that you can go plant in your garden. And so there's a whole lot of people focused on it. And if you search online for monarchs and Monarch Way Station, and you look a little bit at monarchwatch.org and stuff, that's one of the good artifacts of this whole crisis, is that all this really cool information is coming out, and especially on social networking. I'm betting she'll get monarchs. Give it a week or two.
Hang in there, Cynthia.
That's
in
what I
Galloway.
Say. Hang in there.
If you have a question or comment.
We're a sorry case.
Sorry. I don't know if anyone's noticed, but I've been losing my voice, and I apologize for the hoarseness and the lack of inflection. That's what's really killing me. 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call. Otherwise, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. It is our bug empathy session today with Mark Berman. He's the founder and president of Bugman Educational Enterprises. Coming up, we're going to hear in the next segment from really well-known in the business cookbook author of Eat a Bug Cookbook, 40 Ways to Cook Crickets, Grasshoppers, Ants, Water Bugs, Spiders, Centipedes, and Their Kin. So if you have a great bug recipe you want to share, you can give us a call and or email us and share that as well.
He plays harmonica also.
He also plays a harmonica. He's right. Multi-talented. let's get to the Mothapalooza at Burr Oak State Park last month. We usually ignore moths. Oh my gosh, is this a moth caterpillar?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Let's see. I don't know if you guys are even.
You have to describe that. No inflection.
Today? I don't even know.
Just describe it.
But it's green, and it looks like oh my gosh, it's like a okay. Here's the deal. It's like a fireworks caterpillar. It has red sparkles in the front, yellow sparkles along the back, and blue on either side. It's adorable.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's really, I've never seen, what is it? Is it a moth?
Yes, it's called a Cecropia moth caterpillar, and it's one of Ohio's many moths. Guess how many, okay, here's a quiz for you. Guess how many butterfly species there are in the United States? Butterfly species.
20,000?
That's a pretty good guess. Oh. 750.
Okay.
Only 750. 11,000 species of moths.
Oh.
750 butterflies, 11,000 species of moths. And almost nobody knows about any of them. And so that one turns into a big, beautiful moth, a lot like this one.
A lot like this moth.
Yeah, oops.
This guy, uh-oh, I think he lost something.
Look at And I shared this one to you earlier, but I don't know. Is there somebody here? Look, if you're taking pictures.
Yeah, there is. Apparently, the cameras are moving.
See those beautiful eye spots on there? That's
yep,
called
there
a... I never saw the cameras before.
Yeah.
Hi, Mom. That is... Look, and he's shivering. Why do you shiver?
Aww.
Two reasons you shiver.
Cold?
Cold.
Scared.
Both.
Aww.
He can't. His flight muscles aren't warm enough for him to fly, so he's shivering. And actually, he doesn't even have to be that cold. He has to get his flight muscles up to heat anyway. In a minute, he'll take a couple big flaps and then fly off. And then look at those antennas. See his beautiful antennas?
Oh, they're gorgeous. They're like little feathers.
Yeah, and that's how you can tell moths from butterflies. Almost all butterflies have antennas that go straight up, and then there's like a little ball on the end. And so moths either just go straight up like a filament, or they make feathers like this. And that's how you can tell this guy's a boy. The boys have big, huge, beautiful, fluffy antennas, and the girls sort of have these.
Why
little...
is it that the boys are always brighter?
You know,
and
boys are, you know,
yeah.
Boys are cool. And boy crickets make noise, and the girls don't. And boy cicadas make noise, and the boys are noisy and showy because it's dangerous and not very smart. Girls are are smarter, but
more cerebral.
Yes, but if you get stung by a bee, it was a girl.
Oh.
If you get bitten by a mosquito.
It's a boy.
It was a girl.
Oh, no.
Girl praying mantis eats boy praying mantis. Boy never eats girl.
I see a pattern
Black Widow?
Here.
Black Widow?
Quiet but deadly.
Eats her husband. Girls are evil. Boys are noisy. Well, actually, girl bees sting because they sting with their egg layer. And so boys don't have an egg layer, so they don't sting. Girl mosquitoes take blood for the shells for their eggs. Mosquitoes are nectar feeders, just like butterflies. And so, but the girl mosquitoes need protein for their eggs. That's why they suck blood. They're not all evil.
I'm not empathizing with mosquitoes today. I'm sorry. I have to draw a line.
He has big, beautiful antennas because she smells good. And she'll, here, he's getting ready to fly. You ready? Catch him when he flies.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Here he goes. You ready? You ready? Ready? Go. You can do it.
You know, if anyone wants to know what we're doing in here, they can go online and check it out. We're streaming live at WOSU.org.
It sounds
you want
really
to check
exciting.
That out. And it is a really cool moth. And this caterpillar is freaking awesome.
Polyphemus was the name of a cyclops in like the Odyssey or something. And so he's named because for his big eye spots.
Yeah.
We're not going to see him. I'll get him.
Yeah,
later.
It's hard to see. Anyways, you know, it is radio. So let's move on. Let's take some calls.
Okay.
All right.
And
so,
then I wanted to talk about Mothapalooza before we get to it.
Mothapalooza, we definitely want to. Monarch. Okay, you know.
We have to start at 10.
It's Marie in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Marie.
Hi.
Sorry we're so distracted.
Oh, that's okay. Okay. That's okay. We just put milkweed and a spice bush in a couple of years ago. And last fall, I noticed there were tiny little worms on one of the butterfly weeds, and I pinched them off. But this spring, we had caterpillars on one of the other plants, and they were monarch caterpillars, the black, yellow, white. And we were so excited. And for like 3 or 4 days, we would go out and watch them eating the plant, and then actually caught one of them crawling to the spice bush and one of them starting a chrysalis.
Uh-huh.
And the next day, all four of them were gone.
What happens?
We don't know.
You weren't the only ones who saw them.
Mark Berman, what happened?
You weren't the only ones who saw them.
Oh.
Some predator must have seen them.
Or
enthusiast. Either a predator or an enthusiast.
I hope
don't
not.
Know. But that's
well, they're
good.
They're in our backyard. They were protected.
Well,
but not
you don't
from
know.
Critters.
You don't know the enthusiasts I know. Well,
who are they?
No, I'm just kidding. But,
now, we have a whole bunch of chipmunks. Would chipmunks eat them?
I think chipmunks probably eat mostly plant material, but there's lots of things that might eat them, from birds to even ants, I don't know if like a skunk or something might, if it came around, but it would probably knock the plant over. But I would guess it would be like a bird or some kind of bug predator or something. If it was anything, and a lot of people who pay a lot of attention to butterflies and caterpillars, especially, will either like you can get like a sleeve to put over the plant that's like a mesh sleeve to exclude predators from it. It doesn't really always work with ants as well, but a lot of people who do like these caterpillars that eat trees, they'll just put a big sleeve over a whole branch with leaves on it, and then the caterpillars can feed inside of it. Safely. And then a lot of people who do monarchs, and if I was doing monarchs right now, I don't have a yard to do them in, but if I was doing monarchs right now, if I found some, I would take some plant cuttings and move them inside, because right now they're sort of in such a population state that I think I would try to save monarchs as much as possible. So if you see other, and by the way, you said they were on another plant. I don't know if she's still there or not, but you said they were on another plant. And so do you know what kind of plant they were
on? A spice bush?
Yes, we purposely we've got flowers all over our property. We're in the city, but we have no grass to mow.
Yes,
and so yeah, I mean we have.
Well,
hummingbirds.
You're just sucking up to Mark Berman.
Oh, really? It's like a little paradise. In
yeah,
our backyard.
You need a pond.
People come
you need a
and
pond.
We do. We have four.
There
ponds,
you go.
There we go. All
yeah.
right. So, anyways, did you say a spice bush was the other one?
Yes, we put in purposely. We put in butterfly weed. Spice bush, Joe Pye weed, because those are the things that we were told would attract them. And the spice bush apparently is one of the places where they like to put their chrysalis.
Okay.
And that's what was happening.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was going to say, if they were feeding on spice bush, they weren't monarchs, because monarchs won't feed generally on anything other than milkweeds, except in really rare cases. And so if they just went over there to make their chrysalis, that makes sense. They usually leave the plant so that another caterpillar doesn't go and eat the leaf out from over them, essentially, so they fall. And so for them to pupate on spice bush makes sense, but for them to go over, if they were going over and eating some other plant, they probably weren't monarchs, but I imagine you know what monarchs look like. And so, I don't know, but if you find more, save them. Cut a plant near the base and put it in water, and it'll stay fresh almost for one whole caterpillar. It'll stay fresh almost the whole caterpillar's life. So you give up one milkweed, but then you take the caterpillar inside and it doesn't get eaten by birds.
Okay, Marie in Clintonville, thanks a lot. I think this is the Sarah in Blendon Woods that you were talking about. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there.
Oh, hey, Sarah.
Yes, I just thought I would get in and update you folks on the status of the monarch tent at Blendon.
Okay.
You didn't go take that lady's monarchs out of her backyard, did you?
No, but I'm sorely tempted.
Sarah, what is your last name?
My last name is Dalton.
Sarah Dalton at Blendon Woods Metro Park. Okay, give us the update.
We've got about 20 butterflies in the tent at this point.
Nice.
We've let about 50 go in the park already.
Great.
We only keep them for a week, gather the eggs and such from them, and then let them go on and have their life out in the nature, so to speak. If anybody is finding caterpillars in their garden, particularly if they're finding big ones, we could use some at this point, as I've got a gap in my life cycle, in my breeding cycle going on. But we should have adequate numbers for our Monarch Day in September. That'll be September 6th. We have activities all day going on for kids and families. And we're, of course, raising butterflies all summer.
That Butterfly Day that Sarah does is a tradition now, and people look forward to it every summer. It's really fun. They've got all kinds of great Monarch activities. And I think, don't you get stuff from Monarch Watch for that, too?
We do tagging, yeah. We do the tagging.
And so, do you mind, can you describe, I can't describe, but can you describe your indoor display where they make their pupae?
Yeah, we raise most of them in shoeboxes with adequate ventilation, but when they get big, we put them up on a plant cutting, like you said, and let them eat and everything. At some point, they get done eating, they just go up to the top of that and start circling around. And at that point, we know they're done, they're ready to make their chrysalis, and they will often go long distances to make their chrysalis. So whoever that lady was that had caterpillars disappear, they may be fine, they've just gone and hidden. We don't let them do that. We put them over on a special display that actually has a little water moat around it so the caterpillars can't get away. And they're forced to make their chrysalis up on a statue of a butterfly that we have.
And it's really beautiful, and she's got a whole bunch of them hanging off of it, too. You guys should go to Blendin Woods and check that out. They've got beautiful displays there.
Sarah, thank you so much.
Great to hear from
you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
I actually like this.
You can take it.
This is my little fireworks caterpillar that I described earlier.
These are little babies. They're gonna grow. Yeah, I think he's best off just...
The moth is up there. These are babies.
These are little babies.
They're tiny little black things.
Yeah.
They're very small. They're about the length of a fingernail.
It'll take them about 2 weeks to...
And they're pitch black and
it'll take
fuzzy
about 2 weeks to look like this.
And tiny. Oh, these are baby ones of that?
Uh-huh.
My gosh. I tell you, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I want to take one more call before we get going. This is selfish because I wonder about this too. Robert in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
We planted a bunch of little fruit trees last fall, and they're being decimated by Japanese beetles, so we went out and bought one of those bug traps, and we've heard not to buy those, actually, because that just attracts more beetles. But we don't want to use any chemicals on the trees. Do you know?
Can you eat Japanese beetles? Since we're moving into our cuisine section of the show, Robert, thanks a lot for your question. Appreciate it.
David's going to know better. Somebody was just talking about that on one of the entomophagy, and since we're going to be talking about it, PHAG means to eat, so entomophagy.
Oh, I was going to ask him. That was my first question.
Yeah, entomophagy is eating bugs.
Okay.
And so I know that there's a lot of beetles that people do eat, and I want to say I've heard of people eating Japanese beetles. Iridescent colors usually make you nervous, but they don't have real bright colors. Usually bright colors are the warnings.
What is the deal with Japanese beetles? Are there good years and bad years? Good years meaning for them?
Yeah, they're like anything else, but they're also Japanese beetles, which means they're an invasive species.
Okay.
Yeah, and so that's one of the reasons they cause problems. And I don't know if it's ironic or not, but a lot of the problems they cause are on non-native ornamentals also, but also because they're here and in such huge numbers, on native plants also. And frankly, I went to school for a long time to learn how to kill bugs, but I never really had my heart in it. And so I don't really know for sure.
It goes against his nature.
Yes, exactly.
To describe how to get rid
of a bug. And so usually I'm kind of a let bygones be bygones kind of guy, but I didn't buy an expensive fruit tree and put it in my yard.
I tried the traps, though, and I think that's true. It just attracts
Well, I think they catch the boys. I mean, that's a girl smell.
Okay.
And boys, you know, when you're trying to attract boys with girls, it's really easy. And so you get a lot of boys, but really a girl only has to mate with one, and
it
so before
work.
It gets in your trap, you know, he's like, well, that's nice, but first, and before he gets in your trap, if they mate, then they're still going to make more, and they make a lot. Their bugs are good at being bugs.
They're very good at propagating. Yes. My guest is Mark Berman. He's founder and president of Bugman Educational Enterprises. Coming up, we're going to hear from David George Gordon, the author of Eat a Bug Cookbook Revised. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Hurrah, hurrah, we'll all be dead before we're through. Hurrah, hurrah.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. I did not pick that music, but I think that the people who helped me produce this show are finally getting to figure out what my tastes are. Earlier in the program, we talked about empathizing with the plight of bugs in our world, the misunderstood cockroach, the often feared spider, the pesky, disease-riddled mosquito. Now we turn the tables. How about pear salad with Shanghai ants? Or 3B salad? Perhaps curried termite stew. Are you hungry yet? Eating bugs is part of our past, and bug cuisine with its sustainability and nutrients could be part of the future. Still with us, Bugman Mark Berman, entomologist and founder of Bugman Educational Enterprises. And joining us now by phone is the bug chef, David George Gordon, author of The Eat a Bug Cookbook, 40 Ways to Cook Crickets, Grasshoppers, Ants, Water Bugs, Spiders, Centipedes, and Their Kin. Welcome to the show, David.
Well, thank you for having me, Ann.
So, Mark mentioned it earlier, but let's refer back. There's actually a word for bug cuisine.
You know, there's a scientific term, and actually I pronounce it entomophagy. But it
that's
be
what
like
I would have
tomato
done.
Tomato and tomato.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine.
Yeah, right.
Hi, David.
Regardless, I think it's kind of a funny word. I mean, people don't say, I'm going to go out and engage in carnivory tonight, what, yeah. Meaning they're going to a steakhouse.
Hey, speak for yourself, bud.
Yeah, right. There you go. But the whole notion of, you know, going off and this is what cracks me up. 80% of the world's cultures eat bugs. We're kind of the weirdos because we don't. Actually.
What do you think, where did this species split off into the bug eaters and the non-bug eaters?
You know, I think some of it has to do, I have never found a definitive answer, but I think some of it has to do with our investment in agriculture. If you're a hunter-gatherer culture, go out and picking what you can find, and then of course insects are great game. But if you're actually raising like a crop of wheat, for example, and locusts come swarming by, now we're talking about the enemy. I read that insects are the only animals in direct competition with people for food. So eating bugs is sort of like sleeping with the enemy. You don't want to do that in our culture. So I kind of blame it on farming myself.
You're listening
to
All Sides.
It's always Monsanto.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Joining us is David George Gordon, author of The Bug. He is known as The Bug Chef, and he's author of the book, The Eat a Bug Cookbook. If you have a question about bug cuisine, give us a call, 614-292-8513.
By the way, we just like to think we're all that. Red Lobster is a huge restaurant chain, and they make lots of people go there, and they serve big, huge, they got a big bug on their sign.
Right.
I mean, it's a big, and don't think because it lives in the ocean, it's clean. But, you know, lobster, shrimp, crabs, ever go to a crawdad, whatever they call them down.
They have little tentacles and things like that.
Yeah, mud bugs, I think they call those.
Say it again?
Mud
bugs. They call them mud bugs in Louisiana.
Yeah, so, I mean, we eat, and there's bugs in all of our foods anyway, and we just think we're that good. We're just like everyone else.
But.
That's right.
We just don't admit it.
Well, David Gordon, how did you become the bug chef? What was the trigger in your life that spawned this?
Yes.
I wrote the original Eat a Bug cookbook came out in 1998, and it's been in print continuously. That's a long time for a paperback book.
Good for you.
But I actually got the idea, believe it or not, I was working on a previous book called The Complete Cockroach.
Yeah, big favorite.
You want to know about cockroaches. I was looking up people who use cockroaches for medicine or for food, and I just kept finding more and more stuff. This was kind of before Bizarre Foods and, you know, Anthony Bourdain's TV show and things like that. So most of my research was in libraries looking at anthropology journals, how people in Indonesia cook dragonflies, for example. And that really kept me intrigued. Eventually, I had a big fat file folder of photocopied articles about people around the world who ate bugs. And I thought, why don't we do that? You know, well, I'm going to investigate that. And that resulted in the Eat a Bug cookbook.
He also did a talk.
For the last 16 years, I've been out traveling around giving cooking demonstrations, which has really been a lot of fun.
He also did a talk at a conference one time about a banana slug called A Legend in Its Own Slime, which was good. He's a big slug guy, too. He's a big slug, cockroach, yeah. Eating bugs, you know.
I think we
put... I like to root for the underdog.
He's your gross friend.
Yeah. That's right.
We have a picture on our website. The fried green tomato hornworm salad, a perfect way to begin a meal and get revenge on garden pests, perhaps?
That's right. Yeah, if you can't beat them, you might as well eat them.
All right, so let's see. What's the first bug you ever ate that didn't just fly in your mouth when you were riding your bike?
Right, that's right. You know, I actually went to an event. It was an insect fair that was outside of Seattle where I live. And they were serving like Chex Mix with oven-baked crickets in it.
Mm.
So I went, you know, I'm game. I'll try them. I'm kind of an adventurous eater to begin with, not like a maniac, but I thought, this was pretty good. So I tried it. I really liked it a lot. I had seconds, if I recall. And actually, I have that Chirpy Chex Party Mix as the recipe that I modified into my own cookbook.
Just like Mom used to make.
It's in there.
That's right.
By the way, Ann, since I knew we were doing this, here's some crickets if you want to try some roasted crickets.
Yeah, no thanks.
I didn't put anything on them or anything. I didn't want to compete with any recipes.
I've reached the point where if a bug flies in my mouth and I swallow it, I accept it as a good source of protein.
That's right. Value-added food.
Right.
I think it's disgusting to eat anything alive.
All right.
You're horrible.
And then that brings up a good question. You recommend do not eat raw bugs.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of unlikely but not impossible that you can get diseases, parasites, for example, by eating raw bugs. The same thing would be true if you ate raw chicken. I wouldn't recommend anyone do that either.
Okay.
Or, you know, raw pork. But so as a result, what I suggest is that people cook everything thoroughly before they try it. After all, I wrote a cookbook, not a foraging guide.
But that said, there are a lot of people who will go up to like termite mounds or ant nests, and there are certain species that you can just go and eat, and you never see people doing that with chickens, you know?
No.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, first you got to pluck them, and then you, okay. George in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, George.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to share a quick story. When I was teaching a sixth grade science, it was during one of the cicada emergings, and we studied the cicada, and I came across a recipe for fried cicada, and we had several kids that wanted to try it, and we fried them up, and one of the boys bit into it, smiled, and had a cicada wing stuck to his, his face.
Oh, yeah.
And then one of the girls tried it.
Is there lettuce on my teeth?
Yeah, one of the girls tried it. And bit into it, smiled, and then had a terrible look on her face and asked if she could go to the restroom. And she made it as far as the hallway.
Oh, no.
Call the janitor.
Oh, jeez.
You know, I've found through my cooking demonstrations that people are more grossed out by the idea of eating bugs than the actual taste of them.
Yeah.
And actually, I had one kid who was doing a school program, and one kid actually got sick before I even started my program.
Do they all taste like chicken? I mean, what do bugs taste like?
I think they have mild seafood-like flavors. Huh. If you have this, I've done this. You microwave crickets, and you know, of course, we're talking about like 8 seconds before they're overdone. They have a very mild shrimp-like flavor, so they're not competing with, you know, the oil or whatever else you're cooking them in. That's just them.
She's asking you this with flavors. She's asking you this with a plate of crickets right in front of her, and she won't.
That's right.
Yeah, I haven't.
Maybe she has a rule about not eating in front of people who aren't eating.
No,
well.
I don't think so.
To have food in the studio, I think, is the rule. George, thanks a lot for that.
Crickets are really interesting, by the way. I kind of say they're like the coin of the realm because you can get them any time of the year. You know, they're raised commercially to be eaten mostly by pets or as fishing bait, although now there are companies that actually make organic crickets that are designed for human consumption.
A big one just opened in Youngstown where they're making food for human consumption. That's all checked by the FDA and whoever has to check that stuff. But the ones that are raised for pets are kept in highly sanitary conditions. I mean, viruses in a cricket farm are a big, huge problem. They keep it remarkably clean. And also, I mean, I've seen lizards on sale before that were $180,000 for a lizard. And if you feed that crickets, they're going to be really clean crickets. And so food for the pet industry, really, even if it hasn't passed all of the human food stuff, is usually pretty decent food too. Where do you get your crickets, David?
Well, I used to get crickets from a company called Fluker Farms down in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. It's big cricket ranch, if you can imagine that. But more recently, I've been buying them from a company called World Entomophagy. There we have that word again.
Mm-hmm.
They're
World
in
food.
Austin, Texas, and they actually raise crickets for human consumption. Mm-hmm. They're kind of prepackaged and everything.
There's quite a few of them. And, you know, on a recent episode of Shark Tank, I think it was Shapul was the company.
Oh, yeah,
that,
that's right.
They do, there's a guy in Florida who makes cricket powder. I guess you can't call it flour because flour has a certain official designation to be defined
as
flour.
Grain,
but
maybe?
I've heard other things that weren't grains called flours. But anyway, technically it's a powder, but it acts like flour, and you can half and half it with flour and stuff. And they make power bars out of it, like energy bars out of it. And
they're
quite
delicious.
Yeah, as a sustainable protein source. And on Shark Tank, they got $50,000 in Mark Cuban as a partner.
Wow.
To sell cricket-laden power bars.
Just to get into
now they're available all over the place. Yeah. I saw that the other day.
I want to bring another caller on who can just kind of get us into the history of this. Hi, Beth in Columbus.
Hi. I just wanted to say that when I got spotted and my mother got spotted, we both have spotted around the same time. And so there's the Torah and the Bible portion, and then there's like all these rules and covenants that come underneath that pertain to what you're reading.
Uh-huh.
And there's a whole segment in there about what kind of bugs you can eat, what kind of bugs you can't eat, what uh-huh. kind, you know, like you can have the flying ones, but not these kinds. It's very specific. So maybe that has to do something with our ancestors, maybe a little bug phobia.
Do you remember any of the particular bugs that you were allowed to eat? This comes up a lot. I had a woman arguing with me the other day at
okay.
the program in Bexley about whether they're kosher or not. And my understanding is some are kosher.
Some are kosher and some are not. Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? Well, if you think back to the good old days, John the Baptist is probably the world's most famous bug eater. He lived on a diet of locusts and honey.
All right.
That's in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, in Leviticus, they have a whole thing of these you shall not eat, and then these you may eat. And they say locusts are kosher.
Usually herbivores.
Basically are flying grasshoppers. There's a lot of, you know, everything in the Bible has been discussed to death, literally. And there's a lot of discussion as to whether the four or five different animals they're describing are actually either different kinds of locusts or locusts in different stages of development. But it says the rest of these are an abomination.
Yeah, so, I just figured
they're calling my cookbook an abominable book.
I just figured that these guys are out in the middle of the desert in a floodplain. There's bugs. They're going to eat whatever they can. You know, they're going to eat whatever they can.
They're going to forage whatever they can. Beth, thanks for that call. We've been talking a lot about bees, David, and there is a in your index. There's a bee section. And I was wondering, do you distinguish between the kind of bees that we want to protect? Do you want people out there eating those bees or what?
Well, you know, I actually say in my book, the first thing you should do is make friends with a beekeeper.
Okay.
Because what I really like are larval bees. They're still in the honeycomb. Well, then you freeze the honeycomb, you crack it open, you get these little things. They look like little white bullets, and they're actually larval bees. They're quite delicious. The way to do it is, you know, people, because beekeeping has become increasingly difficult, a lot of people raise stingless drones, the male bees, that are actually, they're more attractive to varroa mites, which are one of the problems that bees are wrestling with now. So you can actually ask, you know, the guy, would you please give me a section of your stingless males? And that's, you know, that's not harming anybody, basically. That's taking the overstock right out of the hive.
Well, David George Gordon, thanks so much for joining us today. A lot of inspiration here on this book.
And wait, Japanese beetles. Can you eat Japanese beetles?
Can you eat Japanese beetles?
You know, I've read, I keep reading about, like, there's a guy in Missouri Paul. Who's out harvesting them all the time.
Everybody knows
My own
Paul.
They'd be kind of crunchy. I'd actually rather go for the larva of those Japanese beetles if you could find them.
You're more of a larva guy. I have to cut it off here, though. David George Gordon, thanks again for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Great
for
to talk to you,
me.
David.
David George
Wonderful
Gordon, he's
you, Mark.
Known as the Bug Chef, and he's the author of the Eat a Bug Cookbook. And revised 40 Ways to Cook Crickets, Grasshoppers, Ants, Water Bugs, Spiders, Centipedes, and Their Kin. And Mark Berman, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Mark Berman, he's the founder and president of Bugman Educational Enterprises. Thanks to the All-Side staff, but starting with Charlie Pickard, you did a great job over there in the control booth. Thank you so much, Charlie. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, hope you had a great vacation. Assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants from Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Josh Trannon, and Emily Williams, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. We made you work today, didn't we, guys? Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.